Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, safe play, unsafe skies, and Vladimir Putin's climb to the top of the Kremlin. A new look at some possible secrets from his trip up. But first, a broad discussion of the issue of unsafe skies today, with the downing of the Malaysian jet MH17 over Ukraine by a sophisticated surface-to-air radar-guided missile last week, and the restrictions of airspace around Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport in the midst of Israel's battles in the Gaza Strip with Hamas. Precautionary flight restrictions are in place in both zones today. In the realm of civil aviation, airlines take recommendations about risky airspace. They are also notified about closed security zones that, if violated, may provoke responses from governments or hostile forces on the ground. That's the general lay of the land, or the skies, as the case may be. One thing is true, there are a lot of civilian aircraft and lots of anti-aircraft weapons in the world right now. Can they coexist? Two terrific voices now, Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, instrument-rated pilot, and the author of China Airborne. Hey, Jim.
Hello, John. Nice to talk to you.
Also with us, Stephen Biddle, professor of political science at George Washington University and an adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He also worked on counterinsurgency for General David Petraeus and General Stanley McChrystal. Professor Biddle, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with you, Professor Biddle. How do we understand what capabilities are there on the ground? And we'll get to the issue of how safe civilian passengers should feel flying anywhere in the world today. Let's take Ukraine as an example. We know there's some sort of surface-to-air missile capability in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, the separatists apparently have quite a bit of military hardware. We don't know exactly what they've got, but the State Department has reported that they have at least five T-64 tanks, at least four BMP-2 infantry fighting vehicles, a variety of other armored ground equipment, manned portable air defense systems, the kind of shoulder-fired missiles that seek infrared signals that people talk about a lot, and at least apparently some radar-guided, higher-altitude-capable surface-to-air missiles like the SA-11. Now, they've got a lot of this gear. Having the gear and using it, though, are two very different matters.
And the SA-11 has a range of 70,000 feet, which, of course, is clearly relevant in the MH-17 case. The man-portable missiles, the infrared, as you've talked about them, heat-seeking missiles, they're much lower altitude, right?
That's right. And they also are after very different kinds of targeting information. The kind of shoulder-fired heat-seeking missiles that we know the separatists have and lots of guerrilla organizations have around the world can be fired pretty effectively by a single individual or a small team with very limited contextual information about the situation. They can see the airplane they're firing at. If it's a civilian airliner, they're likely to know it. Radar-guided missiles targeting much higher altitude aircraft or firing at much greater distances are operating with much more abstract information about what it is that they're shooting at. The crews are looking at some combination of very abstract incoming radar information, other data coming to them through a larger communications network that's supposed to establish the context. They can't actually look at the thing, see what it is, recognize what they're shooting at, and making a decision based on kind of classic visual information. It's a much more abstract problem for the crew of a radar-operated missile.
Professor Biddle, that is a very sophisticated way of saying they're shooting at little blobs on a screen, right?
They're shooting at what they can see as a little blob and what other people in a communications network are telling them is or isn't blob type A as opposed to blob type B.
Interesting. On the issue of Gaza and Ben-Gurion Airport in Israel's airspace, is the capability there mostly a threat on takeoff and landing, or are there higher altitude threats as well coming from Gaza and other areas around the West Bank?
Well, I mean, there's a lot we don't know. My guess is that what airlines are worried about primarily is that rockets may hit the apron or the runway. And so aircraft that are taxiing or in the process of taking off or landing might get hit by the kinds of rockets that are being fired at Israeli cities. They also, of course, might be hit by these kinds of short-range, shoulder-fired, heat-seeking missiles. I have not seen any information suggesting that Hamas has the kind of radar-guided, high-altitude anti-aircraft capability that the Ukrainian separatists have.
Stephen Biddle is professor of political science at George Washington University. Also with us is Jim Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, a veteran instrument-rated pilot and author of China Airborne. So, Jim Fallows, as I'm strapping myself into my seat for my, you know, trip overseas, should I be worried about the proliferation of anti-aircraft capability around the world? My pilot isn't necessarily going to know what's below him or her.
In certain areas, of course, this is manifestly a challenge, as we've seen in the past week. The big picture also, of course, is that generally commercial airlines, especially in the first world and in China, are among the safest things you can do with your time. We've had these two horrific episodes, both involving, by coincidence, Malaysia airplanes in the last year, the one that disappeared in the Indian Ocean and this one that was shot down. But generally, over the years, there have been fewer and fewer risks of any kind in commercial airlines. So I think it's a matter of how exactly the airlines are going to work with the international authorities, mainly in the form of the what's called ICAO, and their national authorities, the FAA in the United States, Eurocontrol in Europe, about what is agreed on as being an acceptably safe area for airlines to continue their normal travel over and what has crossed the threshold into being dangerous, which is the issue with Ben-Gurion right now.
What is, you know, is it possible that we are crossing a turning point? If we look back in history, a lot of incidents in the 80s, there was KAL-007, where a South Korean airliner apparently deliberately challenged airspace in Soviet Russia or didn't. In any case, it was a confrontation into controlled airspace. There was the shooting down of the Iranian airliner over the Persian Gulf by a U.S. Navy warship in the midst of a conflict zone there. There have been other shoot downs of planes. Of course, the Lockerbie was a terrorist incident. Can you go back in history and give us any precedent for what's going on today? And are the rules possibly changing, Jim Fallows?
I think the rules possibly are changing. And you mentioned the two main precedents, the Korean Air episode over the Soviet Union and the Iranian one shut down by the Vincennes. And I think it's worth recognizing why to people in the aviation world, things look really different today from the way they did a week ago. A week ago, it was known that there was all this activity in Ukraine. The FAA and some other authorities had simply forbidden flight over the Crimea, and they discouraged it over certain parts of Ukraine, not so much for anti-aircraft problems as because of airspace management disputes between Russia and the Ukrainian authorities, which left them unclear, other countries unclear about who was going to be in control of the planes. But the idea of deliberately using military-scale anti-aircraft missiles capable of going into what we call the flight altitudes, that is essentially 30,000 feet and above, that really is a new concept as a threat. The idea of being vulnerable on takeoff and landing, as you've discussed, or having some of the sort of runway damage, as Professor Biddle was saying in Israel, those were known. The being shot down deliberately by an anti-aircraft high-altitude missile, that was not really contemplated as an active threat even a week ago. And so I think the airlines are now saying, how big of a new phenomenon is this and what do we have to adjust?
Let's talk a little bit about what discretion pilots have, Jim Fallows. You know this up and down. If I'm a pilot and I get up and reading the morning paper over my coffee, see an issue in a country below a flight path that I'm going to travel over, and I notice that there is a international caution over that zone, do I have the discretion as a pilot to say, you know what, I'm just going to veer out of the way here and go out of this zone entirely, even if there's not an actual ban on the airspace, or is it up to some sort of international regulators?
It's a combination of those things. In the middle of flight, pilots have absolute authority to do anything they think to see and be in the safety of the airplane. They can deviate around a storm. Usually they tell the controllers they're doing that, but finally a pilot is assumed to have command authority to make those sorts of decisions. If you're talking about large reroutings to avoid whole airspaces, that's usually a matter that what airlines usually rely on is the governmental authorities, both national and international, to say this is safe, that is not safe. And the presumption here is that the intelligence systems that are required to make those judgments are not something every airline can manage on its own. The international and national bodies are presumably on top of that. Generally, they rely on that. There's a sort of a secondary tier where airlines can, on specific flight plans, they can request various routings. They can say, we'd like to go this way because of weather or because of X, Y, or Z. So that's why some airlines did decide to avoid Ukraine, even while most others were still flying through it. The pilot is in a difficult, unless he wants to declare an emergency in flight, it's hard for him or her just in the middle of the trip to say, well, I think I'm going to give Israel a wide berth on this time.
Great information. Jim Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic, instrument integrated pilot and author of China Airborne. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, John.
Final thought, Professor Biddle. Are airports increasingly a target in this era, and do you see a pattern here?
Well, aviation authorities have been worried for decades now, actually, about rebels or guerrillas or terrorists or insurgents who can locate themselves just outside the secure perimeter of the airport and use these kinds of short-range infrared shoulder-fired missiles to take down aircraft on landing and takeoff. A lot of the fear, for example, when the Gaddafi government fell in Libya was that these kinds of missiles would end up on the black market going who knows where. And there have been known attempts by terrorists to shoot down airliners from these kinds of locations just off the end of the runway, mostly unsuccessful, but that's a matter of luck and happenstance and could very well change. The trouble is that many airports, for example, are located near urban areas, and it's difficult to be able to control built-up potential firing locations near runways. So this problem has been around for a while.
Indeed. Stephen Biddle, professor of political science at George Washington University, adjunct senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now some thoughts on the safety in the woods for your kids. Is it safe out there?
Hi, this is Susan calling from Minneapolis. I'm calling because I'm on my way to pick up my daughter from summer camp. She's 16. She goes to camp for months in the summer. And when you get to camp, they take your phone. And she has been off backpacking, hiking around the mountains, having a glorious time. One of the best things we do for our child all year.
Great, Susan. Of course, not everyone can afford the cost of summer camp these days. Paying a pretty sum to get the youngsters to head out is not an option for all of us. Getting outside to play. Is it a challenge for you to get your kids into the great outdoors?
This is Christina from Tampa, Florida. And my kids don't play outside because it is so hot in Tampa. Their head gets all sweaty, their hair sticks to their face, and they want to come back in.
Here's Chris on Facebook. Of course, outdoor play is great, but many kids with disabilities don't have environments, playgrounds, and accessible outdoor areas they can use and that are ADA compliant.
My name is Maggie from Vancouver, Washington. I find that parents really just need to make a concerted effort when making sure their children get outside to play. I know you're tired when you get home from work. We all are, but you still need to make the effort to make sure your kid has that wonderful outdoor experience.
And, of course, being in gorgeous Vancouver helps. Thanks so much, Maggie. Love your stories and advice and experiences. Play with us at 8778MYTAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Later this hour, the design of risk-free play. The current worsening tensions between Russia and the West are apparently reopening some old mysteries about how Vladimir Putin might have achieved his unchallenged position atop the Kremlin. The UK government has decided to reopen an inquiry into the death of former KGB agent and vocal Kremlin critic Alexander Litvinenko. Litvinenko died in London in November of 2006 under mysterious circumstances. Eventually, doctors found he'd been poisoned with radioactive polonium-210. But how and why? Alex Goldfarb was friends with Alexander Litvinenko and helped him escape Russia. He's the author of Death of a Dissident. Alex Goldfarb, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how do you think the Litvinenko story illuminates Vladimir Putin's rise to the top in any way? Do you?
Yes. Well, Litvinenko and Putin was at about the same time officers of the Russian Security Service, the KGB, in the same rank. And then their path, they kind of went different ways. Putin, of course, became president. Litvinenko worked on organized crime in Russian FSB, which is an equivalent of American FBI, and got upset and very much disillusioned about rising corruption and criminality. So he was kind of an honest cop, a Serpico. And he started complaining. And as a result of his complaints, there was an internal review, and Putin was appointed the director of the FSB, Federal Security Service, as well. Litvinenko was fired for blowing the whistle. He spent a short time in jail on fabricated charges, and then he fled to London, got political asylum, and started working for the British security services on organized crime from Russia. So in the course of these investigations for the MI6, the British Security Service, and for the Spanish secret services, they uncovered a big network of Russian gangsters, mafia, who, it turned out, are linked to some senior figures in the Putin administration. So it became extremely embarrassing. And then one day, Litvinenko, Sasha, as we called him, he gets ill and dies. And the British realized that he was poisoned with this radioactive substance, polonium-210. And they find that two people, former agents of the Russian security services, were those who put the poison into his tea in a London hotel. So those two characters, they flee to Moscow. Russia refuses to extradite them. The British want to arrest them. And ever since, Litvinenko's widow, Marina, a good friend of mine, has been trying to obtain fair and comprehensive investigation of this incident. Russians refused, as I said, to extradite the suspects, and the British government classified, made secret, all of the information outside of the realm of the police. That is, that the police has evidence against two suspects, but who sent them? What was the reason? What Litvinenko was actually doing for the British services? It's all classified. So Marina Litvinenko has been fighting this decision in British courts, and about few months ago, an appellate court took her side and essentially said that the government should establish this public inquiry, which is equivalent to a government commission, which can look both into open and the closed material and make a verdict who was those people who organized and killed Litvinenko.
Who was responsible? We're talking with Alex Goldfarb, a dissident scientist who is friends with Alexander Litvinenko. He's the author of Death of a Dissident, The Poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko and the Return of the KGB. What do you make of the timing of the decision to reopen this inquiry, independent of court rulings?
We believe that it's coincidental. We've been expecting this decision for some time before the Ukrainian crisis started. But having said that, it of course impacts and kind of fits into the general picture of the clash between Mr. Putin's regime and the Western governments. Look, a British citizen, Litvinenko was a British citizen, is killed in broad daylight on the streets of London with a highly toxic substance which only governments have in its possession. 1 gram of this stuff that he was poisoned with is enough to poison half of London.
So do you think Putin looks at this and says, do what you want, I don't care, I'm president of Russia right now? Or is he really concerned about British public opinion, and can this have any effect on Russian public opinion?
Well, public opinion, of course, indirectly has effect on Russia. What's more important is the attitudes of the governments, and in this case the British government and the U.S. government. If you watched foreign policy over these years, the attitude was that we have to appease Mr. Putin, look the other way when he suppresses freedoms and free press and kills dissidents and invades foreign countries and so on and so forth. But over the past year, a gradual realization came that this is not so. Started with the defection of Edward Snowden and ending with this downing of Malaysian plane by Russian armed guerrillas in Ukraine. So all of this, and the Litvinenko case ties into it, changes the general policy towards Russia from a kind of ally. He's being perceived more like an adversary, like a fundamentalist Islamic State, which is bent on doing bad things to the United States and the West.
Some very Cold War-sounding rhetoric there from Alex Goldfarb, a dissident scientist who was friends with Alexander Litvinenko. He's the author of Death of a Dissident, The Poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko, and The Return of the KGB, co-written with Alexander Litvinenko's widow, Marina, commenting on the decision by the UK government to reopen an inquiry into the Litvinenko case. Alex Goldfarb, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
To Capitol Hill now on a story about the challenges for this nation's veterans. Judging from recent machinations in Congress, it's easier to protect for-profit colleges who are generous with their campaign donations than it may be to protect this nation's veterans from being preyed upon by schools anxious to get their hands on GI Bill education benefits intended for men and women who have served this country. Aaron Glanz joins us. He's a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aaron, welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
So you gave us the story of, institutions that have really benefited from federal benefits. Where has this story gone from here?
Well, we found that there was more than $600 million in GI Bill money just in California that was meant to educate Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, but was instead going to for-profit schools that were providing a substandard education. Nearly 300 schools, everyone from unaccredited massage parlors, horseshoe academies, sexology schools, up to big corporate behemoths like the University of Phoenix, which had gotten nearly $1 billion in GI Bill funds, but graduated at its San Diego campus a fewer than 15% of its students. So on Capitol Hill, two Southern California representatives, Susan Davis, Mark Takano, introduced an amendment to a higher education bill earlier this month to try to solve this problem. Here's Representative Takano putting it forward.
Our amendment would help protect our veterans and active duty service members from for-profit colleges who use overly aggressive and deceptive recruiting and advertising practices to market to these brave men and women for the sole purpose of taking their GI Bill and tuition assistance benefits and putting it in their pocket.
That's California Representative Mark Takano. And basically, the bill would put a cap on how much federal money you could get if you were an individual institution. That's part of the bill here.
Yeah, well, that already exists for other financial aid programs, but there's a big loophole for the GI Bill. So these Congress people are saying, hey, there has to be somebody willing to pay you tuition if you're a real educational institution. You can't have a school like the University of Phoenix, which gets 83% of its money from federal financial aid programs, and then on top of it gets $1 billion in GI Bill funds, and then on top of that gets money from the Defense Department. Now, when Representative Takano and Davis introduced this bill, it died almost immediately. Representative John Klein, a Republican from Minnesota, whose biggest campaign contributor is the Apollo Group, which is the parent company of the University of Phoenix, he ruled it out of order. He said it wasn't germane to the issue of financial aid. He would not allow additional discussion on this. But before the ruling was finalized, he did make a comment saying that he opposed it also on its merits.
Unfortunately, this amendment would restrict access to a host of educational opportunities, and many of those harmed would be our nation's veterans. Mm-mm. Veterans are men and women who put their lives on the line in the service of our country. They earn this benefit, and they should be allowed to utilize this benefit in an institution that best suits their personal and financial needs.
Does this effectively kill it? And have you received any response from Representative Klein?
This does effectively kill it. It cannot move forward anymore. The amendment is dead. I asked Representative Klein's office if the campaign contributions, $48,000 since he became chairman of this committee in 2011 from the Apollo Group, his largest contributor, if that had anything to do with his decision to kill the measure. And they said no. He's always favored what his spokesman called a diverse higher education system.
And what do the institutions that are inclined to be affected by this say about what a bill like this would do for them, restrict their access? What's their position on this?
I mean, their position has been that the 90-10 rule, that's the jargon for this, is basically not a good idea, that it has nothing to do with the quality of education they provide. Of course, we in our investigation found that many of these schools do provide a substandard education if you look at the criteria set forward by the state of California, which is that very few of their students are graduating and a high proportion of them cannot pay back their student loans. And these, many of these schools are the leading recipients of federal dollars meant to educate veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
No legislative remedy in sight for this one. Aaron Glantz is a reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, yes, gone are the days of unsupervised diving boards, kids riding in the back of the pickup truck to go get ice cream in the summer, helmetless bicycle riding, that's gone, abandoned rock quarry swimming holes, making the playground swing set go over the top bar. Wasn't that awesome in the old days? Those memorable childhood activities have left a legacy of lawsuit horror stories, possible organ donors, and miles of chain link fence barriers. All this starts to explain why kids perhaps aren't immediately anxious to get outside these days.
Bennett Rogers on the road between Corvallis and Eugene. The reason kids don't play outside is because parents are afraid. I picked up 15 concussions by the time I was 18. My parents were still okay with me playing outside. My friends didn't get to play with me.
Nervous Bennett there in Oregon. We'd love to hear your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE. Post a comment on thetakeaway.org as to whether your kids do get outside to play or if it's a chore. What do you tell them to get outside? Or would you prefer that they stay in the air-conditioned sort of padded room of your own home? In this century where worried parents, realistic risk, and lots more kids have to be factored into the design of play spaces, we decided to talk to the man himself. David Rockwell, legendary architect and designer, founder of the Rockwell Group, is the brains behind Imagination Playgrounds here in New York City. David, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
It's
thanks.
It's great to talk to you. You know, how has the design of play and the aesthetic of play changed in your lifetime? I suspect you may have ridden in a pickup truck or two on the way to the ice cream store.
Well, remember, I was a kid in Mexico, so there were no safety regulations and there were bulls involved, so it was a whole different thing. It's interesting because I got interested in playgrounds because I had two kids and
right.
they were growing up in New York, and there are great playgrounds in New York, amazing looking playgrounds. And as my kids started to get older, I recognized that there was one component of play that had been important to me. And as I started to do research on it, and it was about a 5-year self-initiated research project on play and playgrounds, in some ways, creative risk had been almost intentionally engineered out of playgrounds.
It seemed that way.
And they became about linear play, fixed equipment that you could get approvals on, and as we started to pick at that a little bit, it was really fueled by post 9/11 having built this viewing platform in Lower Manhattan through a foundation. That foundation asked, is there another project we'd like to initiate downtown? I looked around at the playgrounds and I watched how much more fun my kids had playing with the box something came in with than the thing itself. And surprisingly, we went to the city. I assumed they'd be an obstacle.
Because lawyers design playgrounds and insurance companies design play equipment, and that's responsible for this linear play that you were talking about.
That and also I think just sort of if you look at the 70s, late 60s and the 70s in New York, it was a time of enormous experimentation in playgrounds. Richard Dattner's playground in Central Park, Paul Freeberg's.
Right.
playground. And even Louis Kahn and Noguchi collaborated and spent 5 years trying to build a really progressive playground in Riverside and couldn't get it through. As things became more about fencing off one area, in some of the great play spaces in New York, Seward Park, Betsy Head, and Brownsville, which we're now renovating, during the Moses era, were basically replaced with hard surfaces and a continuous fence. So the city turned out to be a fantastic partner because they were very interested in free play. They were interested in unstructured play. And I think they recognized that in order to have kids' lives not dominated by a piece of technology in front of them, that play had to be more engaging. And so that became kind of the way in many years of testing with the city to say, how do we make it safe, but how do we in some ways allow kids to do what they do better than grown-ups, which is dictate how they want to play? Unstructured, child-directed play that is, there's still creative risk. Your thing may not work out. And that's not a bad thing to recognize early on in life. You don't want to break a leg. But learning to collaborate and not have it be linear, parent-directed play
that's a great thing.
Important.
You know, you've described a fusion of eras in New York where this experimental play space development was going on. But also, you know, you can't stop kids. I mean, New York's period of chaos in the 60s and 70s was also a period of free play, the development of graffiti and all the kinds of weird play spaces that, you know, no lawyer is going to approve. But, you know, that's kind of fused into your idea that you're talking about. What have you come up with?
Well, the Imagination Playground started as a permanent location at the South Street Seaport.
Right.
And it is a kind of multi-layered space with hundreds and hundreds of loose parts, really inspired by post-World War II adventure playgrounds in Europe, where kids and volunteers would take rubbish and things they found and make structures together.
Cool.
So we found a way to create that opportunity with a couple of key observations. One is loose parts in a public park without a play associate are really souvenirs.
Right.
So there had to be someone there to manage it if you're going to allow that kind of interaction. And I remember sitting around at the first test play date. There were about 20 adults at a public school. Adrian Benepe was there, a lot of educators. And we watched the kids, and they came out, and they had all these pieces, and no one told them what to do. So the first thing the boys did, a couple of boys took these noodles and started to have a sword fight. You can imagine the adults wanted to break that up right away. Adults didn't move. Then other kids started making individual structures. Within 15 or 20 minutes, you saw kids looking around saying, well, what if I link my thing to your thing? And it was fascinating to see the way it became a kind of collaborative, you know, kid community thing. And the most surprising part of it is after we got the permanent playground built, the city decided to do portable playgrounds without all of the infrastructure. Take all of the expensive infrastructure at the South Street Seaport and just give them the pure creativity. 200 blocks in these crates. And now there are 3,000 playgrounds around the world based on those blocks, including 50 in Haiti that UNICEF has purchased and developed a program. So it's become a kind of movement.
That's so fantastic. And, you know, the kids get it immediately. It took years for New Yorkers to realize that those chairs that they just sit out at public parks in France won't get ripped off.
Exactly.
If you make them look nice.
Right.
You know, a classic sort of design lesson. David Rockwell, have a great day and put some play into your day.
I'm going to work on it. Thank you.
Excellent. David Rockwell, thanks so much.
My name is Jason. I live in Yorktown, Virginia. I happen to live in a bird sanctuary, and I'm really lucky because my kids can go play outside anytime they want, and it's a safe neighborhood. At nighttime, we have no streetlights, and you can just see the stars, and we can hear the owls in the trees, and it's a really wonderful, nurturing community for my boys to be growing up in.
I don't know about you. I'm going to Yorktown, Virginia. Miami, Florida. In the summer, the mosquitoes are the size of a small helicopter, and the heat in Miami is horrible, writes Janet. In winter, we love to be outside. A good swing set is the best investment.
My name is Trista Cignano, and I live in Atlanta. I let my son play outside in the front yard all the time, and luckily, living in the city, we have a lot of walkable, bikeable streets and a lot of kids in the neighborhood, so the kids do get to go outside and play. unfortunately, is not unsupervised like it used to be when we were younger, but they do go outside and play a lot.
This is Laura Jean in Portland, Oregon. My children play outside all day, every day. I open the door, I tell them to go outside and play, and they do. I think sometimes parents just need to take the risk that there's going to be a skinned knee, and it's okay.
All right, I'm out of here. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.